refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Good to have you with us. It's 12 noon here in Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. We'll start this hour's programs with our news bulletin. They will be followed by Bookshelf. The program introduces authentic and reputable Islamic books that have been written or translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hamas hailed the killing of an Israel-backed militia leader in Gaza, saying it is the inevitable fate of those who betray their people and become Israel tools. Iran condemns unilateral sanctions imposed on some countries, saying they target the life and health of entire populations and amount to crimes against humanity. And a new survey shows workplace morale is falling among U.S. diplomats under Trump administration. Everyone, welcome. You've tuned into World News Live from Tehran with me, Zainab Zakaria. Thank you so much for joining us. Hamas has hailed the killing of Israel the inevitable fate of all those who betrayed their people and homeland and become tools in the hands of the regime. Hamas said Abu Shabab's criminal act represented a blatant departure from Palestinian national and social consensus. The movement commended families and tribes that disavow him and withdrew all tribal and social protection from his isolated group that represented only itself. Hamas further asserted that Israel's use of such socially bankrupt and lawless gangs in Gaza reflects its utter helplessness. It stressed that Israel, which has failed to protect its own agents in Gaza, cannot protect any of its proxies. Hamas affirmed that the unity of Palestinian people will remain a bulwark against efforts made to undermine its internal fabric. Abu Shabab, who led an Israeli armed militia, was killed alongside his two deputies. The militia was accused of looting aid and attacking Palestinian civilians as well as Hamas fighters. His death has sparked street celebrations across Gaza. Hamas has also condemned the systematic execution of Palestinian abductees following Israel's confirmation that three civilians abducted from Gaza have died in its jails. Two of the abductees died respectively 2 months and just 1 day after being taken in by Israeli forces, while the third one died approximately 1 year after his abduction. Hamas called for immediate international intervention to force Israel to return the bodies of those who have died in its prisons and hold perpetrators of such brutal crimes accountable. Hamas described Israeli prison conditions as barbaric, citing torture, deliberate medical neglect, starvation, and physical assaults. It called on the UN and other human rights organizations to open an international investigation into Israel's crimes against abductees. The movement also urged all possible pressure to be exerted on Israel to make it end its prison abuses, which blatantly violates the principles of international law. Over 100 Palestinian abductees have died in Israeli prisons since October 2023, 50 of them from Gaza. Among the ruins of Gaza's academic institutions, students have begun returning to what remains of their campuses, trying to challenge the Israeli systematic campaign to dismantle the territory's educational infrastructure. Our correspondent Gada Ibrahim has a report.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebox among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned, despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim, Gaza City, Palestine.
And in Europe, the national broadcasters of Ireland, Spain, and the Netherlands have announced that they will boycott the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest. The announcement came after the European Broadcasting Union decided to allow Israel to participate in the upcoming competition. The three countries were among several parties that have called for Israel's exclusion, citing the heavy human toll in Gaza and accusations of unfair voting practices. Earlier, Eurovision said it will not hold a vote on Israel's participation in the musical contest. Dodging calls for the regime's ban over its ongoing crimes in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The decision prompted the three broadcasters to confirm their withdrawal, stating that it does not reflect the ethical values the contest should uphold. Other international bodies, such as the International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, have also sidestepped calls to bar Israel from participation in competition over its genocide in Gaza. Critics say those refusals point to double standards that have shielded Israel from accountability. They cited past actions against countries such as Russia, which was swiftly banned by FIFA and UEFA within days of Russia's attack on Ukraine in 2022. Investigative journalist Tony Goslin says the Eurovision controversy over Israel's participation exposes deeper problems in the global music industry.
The music industry has been infested by money and people trying to make money from it and people using it for propaganda, like the Israelis. So it's really good to see the Dutch, the Spanish and the Irish and the Slovenians all saying, we're having nothing to do with this anymore. So for two reasons, really. One is it's run its course. There are better songwriters and singers on the streets of Bristol busking for a few pennies from passers-by than you'll find in this Eurovision Song Contest nowadays. If you go back over the last even 30 years, back to apartheid South Africa, you will see that many musicians who are actually good at what they do, I'm talking here about people like Eric Clapton, etc., Van Morrison, people who've got a little bit of integrity as a musician, and they're not just looking for the money from the music industry, they have boycotted many, many events. For example, Israeli events, Israeli-sponsored events. Back in the 1980s and early 90s, it was South African events. And so you can see that the pressure, political pressure, that musicians can put on, they're very much aware of that. And so this is really echoing the very best, but this boycott, of the British musicians, the British music industry that we've seen over the years, boycotting racism.
Iran has marked the International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures by condemning unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. as illegal and inhumane. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei argued that unilateral coercive measures violate fundamental principles of human rights, such as the right to life, health, education, and development. He added that by targeting the lives and health of entire population, unilateral bans amount to crimes against humanity. Bogai stressed that the U.S. must be held accountable for committing crimes against humanity through the application of illegal and inhumane sanctions against the peoples of the developing countries, including Iran. Washington has imposed hundreds of sanctions on Iran under various pretexts, ranging from human rights to the country's peaceful nuclear program. The International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures was designated by the UN General Assembly through the adoption of resolution in June 2025. Robert Inglakesh says unilateral U.S. sanctions are designed to pressure other states into submission.
They essentially use the sanctions to bully countries into being their slaves. There's no other better way to put it, to be honest. That has to be put bluntly like that. If you are not the slaves of the United States, if you don't implement certain social programs that you want to, if you don't change your culture to in the way that the United States seeks for you to do so at a certain given moment in time, and if you do not adhere to constraints and to the demands of its foreign policy, then you will be torn apart. And if you have resources and the United States wants those resources or wants certain deals, it is like a gangster. It holds a gun against your head. The sanctions are there, and then you know that right around the corner is its military, which is, of course, one of the most powerful on the planet. There is no way to prevent this. It is a matter of nations which are, like you said, in this emerging multipolar world on the opposite side of the political divide to come together and work with each other independent of the United States.
The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Ground Force have held Sahan 2025, a five-day joint military exercise with Shanghai Cooperation Organization member state in the northwestern city of Tabriz. All 10 full members took part with the objective of sharing experiences and building synergy among SCO members in the fight against terrorism. Mohin Amini has a report.
But united by a shared agenda of fighting terrorism, military units from Shanghai Cooperation Organization member states participated in Sahand 2025, a five-day joint anti-terrorism exercise hosted by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Grand Force, the northwestern city of Tabriz.
The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a flag bearer in the global fight against terrorism, are proud to host the counterterrorism exercise under the leadership of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is itself the leading force in counterterrorism efforts.
All 10 full members of the SCO, including China, Russia, India, Pakistan, Iran, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, took part in the exercise, which brought together a total of 120 personnel. Observers from SCO dialogue partners, such as Oman, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, were also present.
In this exercise, we will conduct simulations of scenarios involving engagement with terrorists using live ammunition. After monitoring the terrorist adversary and engaging step by step up to the moment of decisive contact, the terrorist's route is blocked and they are pushed back. Ultimately, we will carry out an aerial assault using helicopters and heliborne insertion. Hostage rescue and search and rescue operations will also be conducted.
Fighting terrorist groups such as the U.S. and Israeli-backed Jaish al-Adl in the east and the Kurdish militant group PKK in the west have put Iran at the forefront of the fight against terrorism, with the IRGC leading the efforts.
Iran has long-standing and classical experience in counterterrorism. We welcome the sharing of these experiences within the regional anti-terrorist structure. We are now here to witness the implementation of joint exercise plans.
With these kind of drills, member states try to upgrade their capabilities and also to share their knowledge and experience in fighting terrorist groups.
Terrorism knows no borders and requires a joint response. The IRGC brings extensive field experience, having fought Daesh in Iraq and Syria under the leadership of the anti-terror commander, Artillery Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
The evolution toward the new global order has made the world's largest group of countries eager to pursue a realistic understanding of terrorism. That is why the SCO member states believe Iran is the right place to prepare against the phenomenon. Moin Amini, Tabriz.
To the U.S. now, where a new survey shows morale inside America's diplomatic corps has collapsed, with most of U.S. diplomats reporting worsening conditions under President Trump. According to data obtained from the American Foreign Service Association, 98% of professional diplomats reported poor morale. More than 80% said it has become harder to carry out U.S. foreign policy under Trump. The findings highlighted the concerns expressed for months by career diplomats and foreign policy experts about impact of Trump's changes to State Department and foreign assistance programs. Large-scale layoff, shrinking resources, and politicization of workforce are among the problems the U.S. Foreign Service has been facing since Trump came into office in his second term. And staying with the U.S., the War Secretary Pete Hegseth is in hot waters over several controversies, including the one related to military strikes against Yemen. The Pentagon's Inspector General has concluded that Hegseth's sharing of information about attacks on Yemen via messaging app Signal violated department protocols. The inspector's report says using a personal cell phone to send non-public information could have caused harm to U.S. military personnel. Hegseth is also under scrutiny over two U.S. strikes on an alleged drug trafficking boat in the Caribbean in early September. The controversy emerged following a Washington Post remarks report that shows survivors from an initial strike were killed after Hegseth ordered to, quote, kill everyone. And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. As always, more is on our website to keep you updated. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to The Bookshelf. I am Nasreen Sayed, and we are going to be talking about a book called Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela. When we think of Nelson Mandela, most of us picture the global icon, the statesman, the president, the man who became a symbol of freedom and reconciliation. But Long Walk to Freedom, his autobiography, reminds us that behind that image was a long, difficult, and very human journey. It is a story of a boy born in rural South Africa in the Eastern Cape who grew up herding cattle, playing stick-fighting games, and absorbing the traditions of his people, and who went on to become one of the most influential figures of the 20th century. The book takes us through every stage of Mandela's life, his education, his gradual awakening, to the brutal reality of apartheid, and his decision to dedicate himself to fighting it. We follow his involvement with the African National Congress, his leadership in the anti-apartheid struggle, and of course, the extraordinary 27 years he spent in prison. And we end with his release, his election as South Africa's first black president, and his effort to guide a nation through one of the most remarkable transitions in modern history. But this isn't just a history lesson. It is a deeply personal account. Mandela shares not only the victories, but also the doubts, the sacrifices, the loneliness, and the cost of choosing a path that demanded so much of him and of his family. And that's part of what makes his book so powerful. It is not just about what he accomplished. It is about who he had to become in order to accomplish it.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
The central themes of Long Walk to Freedom are freedom, justice, perseverance, and moral courage. Mandela shows us that fighting systemic oppression requires enormous sacrifice. Not only the years of his life spent behind bars, but also the personal toll it took on his relationships and family. Yet, just as important as his perseverance is his capacity for forgiveness. His story shows that true leadership is not about power or revenge. It is rooted in integrity, humility, and a vision of dignity and equality for all people. And that philosophy is what makes this book resonate far beyond South Africa. Mandela teaches us that progress is rarely quick or easy. It requires patience, persistence, and the ability to maintain hope, even when the odds seem impossible. So, why should you read Long Walk to Freedom? Because it's more than an autobiography of one man. It is a roadmap for resilience, for justice and leadership in the truest sense. And it reminds us that history is shaped not only by speeches and victories, but by sacrifice and perseverance, and the daily choice to remain true to one's principles. Let us read part of the book after the break.
IRIB English Radio.
Apart from life, a strong constitution, and an abiding connection to the Thembu royal house, the only thing my father bestowed upon me at birth was a name. My name literally means pulling the branch of a tree, but its colloquial meaning, more accurately, would be troublemaker. I do not believe that names are destiny or that my father somehow divined my future, but in later years, friends and relatives would ascribe to my birth name the many storms I have both caused and weathered. My more familiar English or Christian name was not given to me until my first day of school. But I am getting ahead of myself. I was born on the 18th of July, 1918, at Mvezo, a tiny village on the banks of the Mbashi River, in the district of Umtata, the capital of Transkei. The year of my birth marked the end of the Great War, the outbreak of an influenza epidemic that killed millions throughout the world, and the visit of a delegation of the African National Congress to the Versailles Peace Conference to voice the grievances of the African people of South Africa. Mvezo, however, was a place apart, a tiny precinct removed from the world of great events, where life was lived much as it had been for hundreds of years. The Transkei is 800 miles east of Cape Town, 550 miles south of Johannesburg, and lies between the Kei River and the Natal border, between the rugged Drakensberg Mountains to the north and the blue waters of the Indian Ocean to the east. It is a beautiful country of rolling hills, fertile valleys, and a thousand rivers and streams, which keep the landscape green, even in winter. The Transkei used to be one of the largest territorial divisions within South Africa, covering an area the size of Switzerland. With a population of about 3.5 million and a tiny minority of Basothos and whites. In 1937, when I was 19, I joined Justice at Helltown, The Wesleyan College in Fort Beaufort, about 175 miles southwest of Umtata. In the 19th century, Fort Beaufort was one of the number of British outposts during the so-called Frontier Wars, in which a steady encroachment of white settlers systematically dispossessed the various Xhosa tribes of their land. Over a century of conflict, many Xhosa warriors achieved fame for their bravery. Men like Makanda Sandile and Makoma, the last two of whom were imprisoned on the Robben Island by the British authorities, where they died. By the time of my arrival at Helltown, there were few signs of the battles of the previous century, except the main one. Fort Beaufort was one white town where once only the Xhosa lived and farmed. Although I was prevented from attending the 1952 annual conference, I was immediately informed as to what had transpired. One of the most significant decisions was one taken in secret and not publicized at the time. Along with many others, I had become convinced that the government intended to declare the ANC and the SAIC illegal organizations, just as it had done with the Communist Party. It seemed inevitable that the state would attempt to put us out of business as a legal organization as soon as it could. I cannot pinpoint a moment when I became politicized, when I knew that I would spend my life in the liberation struggle. To be an African in South Africa means that one is politicized from the moment of his birth. Whether one acknowledges it or not. An African child is born in an African's only hospital, taken home in an African's only bus, lives in an African's only area, and attends African only schools, if he attends school at all. When he grows up, he can hold African only jobs, rent a house in African's only township, and ride African's only trains, and be stopped at any time of the day or night and be ordered to produce a pass, failing which he will be arrested and thrown in jail. We have been reading from the book Long Path to Freedom by Nelson Mandela, and you've been listening to IRIB English Radio and The Bookshelf. My name is Nasreen Syed, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Sistan Baluchistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahani Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahani Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahani Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahani Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimimo reservoirs in the south of Zobel are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zobel and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zobel to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural, and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery, to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk beautifully designed. And also I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artists to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated dolls displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts.
Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran. Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Middle East Stream. The program analyzes the latest developments in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And we round up this hour's programs with insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, and we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Midstream.
XIV has arrived in Lebanon on an official pastoral visit, a journey framed by appeals for peace and interfaith dialogue, but shadowed by deep frustration in parts of the country that his schedule will not reach. I'm standing here to speak directly to that absence. Lebanon's south was among the areas most devastated during the 2024 war. Entire towns saw homes, schools, and places of worship reduced to rubble, and Christian communities there suffered alongside their Muslim neighbors. Independent assessments and UN reporting documented widespread damage to civilian infrastructure and religious sites across southern municipalities, yet the papal itinerary amidst those southern towns. For many families in villages from Tyre to the border, that omission feels like a missed moment of pastoral solidarity. Khan al-Jalil, part of the broader Tyre region and a site venerated in local Christian tradition because of its links to gospel narratives, is emblematic. A place where memory, identity, and history meet, and where several Christian landmarks were harmed in the fighting. The absence of Khana from the schedule is experienced not as a minor logistical detail, but as the absence of recognition for communities that endured bombing, displacement, and loss. There are concrete reasons that can shape a papal route: security considerations in a fragile ceasefire, diplomatic calculations, and the logistics of protecting the pontiff in a still volatile environment. Those are real constraints and they matter. But pastoral leadership also carries a symbolic weight. When a faith leader passes through a nation marked by recent trauma, his presence in the hardest hit places can be a profound source of consolation and public witness. Many Lebanese Christians in the South feel the balance here has tilted away from that witness. Finally, on Gaza, Pope Leo XIV has urged investigation and called for respect for human dignity, but has been cautious about using the legal label genocide as an outright declaration. That stance aimed, the Vatican says, at a careful legal assessment, has frustrated Palestinians and many Christians who live under siege or who have lost family. For Gazan Christians, too, the suffering is real and immediate. Their pain is part of the human story the Pope came to Lebanon to acknowledge. This visit can still matter deeply. What those in the South and Gaza seek now is not polemics, but recognition, that their losses are seen, their churches and homes remembered, and their calls for justice met with concrete compassion. A papal presence in those places would have been a powerful sign that no community is left outside the circle of care. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Pope Leo XIV begins his historic visit to Lebanon, his message of unity and compassion is overshadowed by growing discontent among communities who feel unseen. Today we examine why the omission of South Lebanon and the Vatican's reluctance to label the massacre in Gaza a genocide is raising painful questions for Eastern Christians living under constant threat. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Miriam Sharabati, political commentator and writer. It's a pleasure having you with us, Miriam. And I know you can be with us because of the actual papal visit in Lebanon. The roads are mainly closed in most of the Lebanese territories where the Pope will be visiting. But as a Lebanese Christian yourself, how do you interpret the Pope's decision to exclude the south of Lebanon, a region where churches were bombed, families were displaced, and Christian heritage sites like, for example, Khan al-Jalil, where Jesus Christ performed his first miracle, they were devastated by the war. What kind of message does this send to communities who expected pastoral solidarity rather than just diplomatic caution?
Right. First of all, thank you for having me. When we look at what the decision of the Pope visiting Lebanon, excluding the South, first of all, we must understand that no Pope in the history of the visits has ever visited southern Lebanon. And this time, particularly, until now, so we've seen the Pope meet all the Lebanese officials in the presidential palace. We have not heard a single word regarding Israeli aggressions. Right? We didn't hear it from the Pope. We didn't particularly hear it from the Lebanese president either. So when we look at that, it feels like once again, Eastern Christians, especially Arab Christians, outside of the realm of Kirke, right? So the Christian Maronites of Lebanon are being slightly abandoned. Right? We're not talking about the Christians of Akkar, so northern Lebanon, where they face a lot of issues, and they currently face a real existential threat from the Syria side. We're not talking about the Christians in the Bekaa, where they're getting bombed as well. We're not talking about the Christians of the South, who have been living under existential threat, and who are the people where Jesus Christ has actually walked and passed, and where the disciples have been, right? It holds a high Christian value, but we haven't seen any real position to tell those people that they should stay in their land, to tell those people that, well, you martyred inside your churches, and we understand the meaning of that, and we stand by you, right? We did not see any of that. And in my opinion, I don't think that's a slip on Vatican's end, because we didn't even see it from the Lebanese Christian leadership to a large degree. I don't want to put all of them together because we did see a good number of clergy visit, but they're not mostly Catholics, right? So that brings us back to the topic of Vatican. Is Vatican here to realign the positioning of the church to fit the needs of the people? Or is Vatican putting again a policy that fits a larger vision of a changed Middle East? And I think this is a question we are asking, mm-hmm. and no one is sure yet. We're waiting to see where the visit goes.
And that policy that you mentioned, Miriam, we've seen with the Pope repeatedly avoiding using the word genocide when referring to what happened in Gaza, even though we have a Gaza's Christian community that has suffered alongside its Muslim population due to this genocide. How does this linguistic hesitation really affect the morale and trust of Eastern Christians who feel abandoned by Western church leadership?
That position of neutrality of Vatican, which it had adopted, or alleged neutrality, if I'm going to call it, because he did meet with Bartholomew in Turkey, and Bartholomew is a controversial person within the Orthodox Church, who had stood with Ukraine in the face of Russia. In the Nazi era, Vatican had no issues in having connections with Nazi Germany, right? In Latin America, when the U.S. coups were happening, Vatican stood with the elites in the face of liberation theology and otherwise the people. Right? We've seen a repeated position on this. In Lebanon specifically, the visits of the last popes, so the ones in the 90s, they all came at very critical moments. Mm-hmm. While the visit of St. John Paul II stood significantly different it still felt like a sense of abandoning to a certain degree, but his visit to Damascus and his speech from Damascus particularly angered the Israelis. He was very clear in his position, even within the scope of the neutral language. So what I'm trying to say is that that neutral language, you can't have a position without explicitly stating that you stand opposed to Israel. But to explicitly state that there isn't a genocide in Gaza, I think you're making a statement. You're not standing neutral, especially that on his trip from Turkey to Beirut, on the plane, he was asked about the Palestine-Israeli conflict, right? Because that's the framing they would offer. And his answer was, there is one solution, which is Palestinian statehood, and until today, the Israelis have rejected that solution. All right, now we know this. What's the position of Vatican? Are we waiting until Israel is accepted for another 70, 80 years? Or
maybe wipes out the entire population? But
exactly, another 100,000.
Wrapping up this visit, Miriam, if you want to wrap up this visit, which is still ongoing in Lebanon, in your view, what long-term impact does this visit with its omissions and restrained language leave on the relationship between the Vatican and the Eastern Christians living under the reality of Israeli entity aggression? Do you really believe this will widen the gap between lived Christian experience in the East and the political positioning of global Christian institutions, which for some reason is siding with Israel?
I think to a large degree it will have a divided response, because for the Christians in Lebanon that are making pro-Zionist statements, Vatican will come and say, listen, you cannot do that. You cannot hate the Muslims in your community, basically, because Vatican has no interest in that. At the end of the day, they do work from an interest-based perspective. And when it comes to the Christians that are anti-Israel and are pro-resistance, it will come to them and say, well, listen, if you're going to keep doing that, we have nothing.